Hi, this is Kelly, and you're listening to Chemist Corner Podcast for Wednesday, February 10th, 2010.
Welcome to Chemist Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, and with me is my co-host and coolest cosmetic chemist in the world, Kelly Dobos.
Hi, Perry.
Hello, Kelly. Chemist Corner is a podcast about cosmetic science and is broadcast to help educate, entertain, and inspire current and future cosmetic chemists. The information and opinions discussed on Chemist Corner are those of the hosts and the guest alone. They do not necessarily reflect those of any past, present, or future employer. In this episode, we will discuss some cosmetic science news, answer listeners' questions, we'll have an interview with Johan Vikers, and finally finish with a brain challenge. It's a pretty packed show, isn't it, Kelly?
It is indeed.
Yes. So how are you doing today?
I'm good today. Today was a busy day, and I made a trip to the gym this afternoon.
Oh, doing a little running, are you?
Yeah. I'm training for my first half marathon this May.
Ah, that's the Flying Pig Marathon, or half marathon, right?
Yeah, the Flying Pig, Cincinnati's Marathon.
Yeah, I think I did that one in 2003 or something, way back when. So what was that thing with your lab coat turning pink?
Oh, you know, I've always wanted a pink lab coat, but I guess, you know, I finally have one, except it was purely accidental. I happened to accidentally get a pink sweater in my load of white laundry this weekend. So yeah, I have a pink lab coat and several other pink t-shirts now.
Oh, how fun.
It looks nicer than it was before, so.
You know, I miss my lab coat. I used to love wearing a lab coat. You know, I would fill it with, like, cards and ropes and coins, and I would always just walk around and do magic tricks. That was fun. And then the finger puppet shows, it was just the whole thing. I had a lot of fun in the lab, let me tell you.
It sounds like you did.
All right, let's start off with the news. We're going to just talk about one story today because there's a lot to talk about this story. You know that guy Dr. Oz? He's got a show. He was like the guy from Oprah, but now he's got his own show. So this Dr. Oz character.
Yeah, I definitely heard a lot about Dr. Oz and seen him on Oprah.
Yeah, well, anyway, Dr. Oz, he has a website, and he had this article titled The Price of Beauty. And there were such outrageous claims there that I thought we had to talk about it. Because, you know what, I hear claims like this, not just from him, but from lots of different companies. It just really troubles me. So I thought we could go through and look at some of the things he said in the article. The article starts out and says that really it's all about how your beauty products are poisonous and they're awful for you and you should be afraid to use them. But one of his specific claims was that beauty products are unregulated, made from hazardous substances, and potentially harmful to your health. Geez, why would anyone want to use beauty products? Now, to that claim when he says no beauty products are subject to FDA approval, that's one of the claims that he makes. And I hear this a lot from people. And really, technically, cosmetics, they don't really need to be approved before being sold to the public. So in that way, they're not really regulated by the FDA. Would you agree?
Right, I agree. The FDA doesn't necessarily approve cosmetics, but the cosmetic industry itself is self-regulated by the manufacturers in that industry.
That's through the PCPC, right? Personal Care Products Council? Yeah.
That's correct, the PCPC.
Now, the FDA does regulate drugs, but, you know, I looked at the FDA's website about their regulation of cosmetics, and there are actually some things that they do regulate. Did you know that there are ingredients that are specifically banned from cosmetics by the FDA?
Yes, there are.
Among those are chloroform, methylene chloride, mercury compounds. I mean, who doesn't want mercury compounds in their cosmetics, right? And that the FDA regulates all the color additives. So to say that beauty products are not subject to FDA approval is a bit of an exaggeration.
I agree with you.
And the other piece that is regulated is OTC products like dandruff shampoos, sunscreens, hair growth products, anti-acne things, etc. From my standpoint, it seems like there's a fair amount of regulating going on.
I think Dr. Oz is manipulating anxiety with those statements.
Yeah, I don't exactly understand. It's not like he's trying to sell something, is it?
He's trying to sell his show.
Yes, I guess it makes a better story to say cosmetics are killing you, don't you? Than it does to say your cosmetics are perfectly fine.
Right. By sensationalizing it, he's probably hoping to increase his viewership. And I think that's kind of a misguided reason for doing what he's doing.
Looking through this article, there were a few more things that he said. He specifically talks about makeup and the particles, but then he goes on and says that there are no studies showing any kind of damage from makeups. Just in the same thing, at the same time when he says they might be dangerous, he says there's no proof that they're dangerous. So I don't really get that. Really, there's no evidence that particles from your makeup are dangerous, so I don't think that's a thing to worry about. And then he had a bit about wrinkle product.
Well, I think in the same vein of, you know, things being contradictory, he claims that wrinkle creams damage the skin to produce a wrinkle-free effect, but then goes on to recommend retinol as an anti-aging ingredient. And retinol, although probably the most effective anti-aging ingredient we have, has been shown to cause irritation in some skin. So that's kind of contradictory to me to recommend that. He also recommends vitamin C, which also has a questionable effect on skin aging. That was interesting. Another comment he made was that they're engineered to penetrate deep into your skin where blood vessels are. Now that right there is something that we cosmetic chemists avoid. When you talk about penetrating the skin, especially down to where the blood vessels are in your dermis, that would make the product a drug product, and we avoid doing anything in that area.
Yeah, that's a common claim you hear for a lot of people is that you know, your skin is just like a sponge and it just absorbs anything you put onto it. Which always makes me wonder, like if it really did do that, why do we even use mouths to eat? Why couldn't we just like put an apple on our skin and why wouldn't it just absorb into your body?
Right. And I think if you talk to anyone who's designing products for transdermal delivery or studying skin penetration, it can be very difficult to get molecules to penetrate them because of their size and polarity and so forth. So I don't think as cosmetic chemists, we're working to penetrate the skin all the way down to the dermis. We're working within the stratum corneum for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if things could penetrate, why would you even have shots in anymore, you know? Or people taking insulin, they wouldn't need to like use a shot. They could just put it on their skin and it would go right through, right? Dr. Odd, finally, he ended up talking about lip products and how dangerous those are. One of the most outrageous claims was that putting petrolatum lip products on your lips, you end up eating it, which is essentially the same as drinking gasoline.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous, Perry. There's a lot of difference between gas and petroleum jelly.
So you're saying petroleum jelly is not gas? You couldn't just, like, fill up your car with Vaseline and then keep going?
That's correct. Yes. The gasoline we put in our cars is quite different from petroleum. It is a hydrocarbon, but the carbon chain lengths range from about 4 to 12. And the gas we put in our cars also has a lot of other additives mixed in with it. Petroleum jelly is mainly hydrocarbons above 25 in carbon chain length. So that's quite a difference in properties. And I think the good doctor also forgot to look up the FDA's OTC monograph for skin protectant, which also has petrolatum in the category of generally recognized as safe and effective as a lip protectant in use levels of 30 to 100%. So right there, the FDA is, you know, letting us know that petroleum jelly is safe to use, or petrolatum is safe to use in lip products at 100% level.
So you could practically eat the stuff.
Exactly.
And speaking of eating, this is another thing that I found funny. He made this claim that if you add up the amount of lip gloss that the average woman uses and consumes over a decade, it's going to equal about 7 pounds. This got me thinking. So I looked it up, and there's a 2005 article that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Food and Chemical Toxicology. That sounds like a real page-turner, doesn't it? So they had an article. It was called Exposure Data for Cosmetic Products, Lipstick, Body Lotion, and Face Cream.
Ooh.
I went through it. I looked that up. Do you know what the average amount of women who use lipstick put on their lips? How much in terms of grams per day?
I do not.
It's about 0.024 grams a day. And so if you do the math, okay, if you do 0.024 grams a day, you do the math, 365 days over 10 years, you end up with a grand total of 87.6 grams. That doesn't seem that close to 7 pounds, does it?
That is not close at all to 7 pounds.
So I don't know where he gets this 7 pound claim, but clearly the evidence in peer-reviewed literature is saying that that's not really true.
I completely agree. So do you have any suggestions for improvements to Dr. Oz's show, Perry?
Here's my suggestions to Dr. Oz. It seems that, at least when it comes to beauty products, Dr. Oz doesn't have really a good research staff, because if they did, they would have found out these obvious flaws in what he's saying. The other thing I'd like to say is that people need to be more skeptical. Skeptical is stuff you hear on TV shows. There are people that are just out there to shock you, and it just makes people want to watch more when it's shocking. But the truth is, there is no evidence that cosmetic products are poisoning people. They're not poisoning people. They're perfectly safe. And we as cosmetic scientists should just remind the public that really, we're not trying to kill anyone. Are we? Are we trying to kill people, Kelly?
I think that's a complete opposite of what we're trying to do. We're trying to make people's lives better.
Okay, Kelly, this is a question from a reader. How do you make a formula less expensive? So a lot of times as a cosmetic scientist, you're going to sort of inherit a formula, or you're going to create this great product, great formula, which is fabulous, and your marketing people will say, hey, I love it. It's perfect. Can you make it 5 or 10 cents cheaper? So when you have you ever run into anything like that, Kelly?
Oh, of course, Perry, of course. Well, you can look at reducing non-critical ingredients. You can also find alternative suppliers for your raw materials who may be able to give you a better price because of higher volumes or something of that nature. One of the things I find that often adds a lot of cost to a formula too is fragrance. So that may be a place to look for cost savings as well. What are your thoughts, Perry?
Well, of course, you make some good points there. Another thing that you can do is you can sometimes find a similar raw material that's less expensive, so just try to substitute it out there. And then if it all comes down to it, you just add a little bit more water to your formulas. It's a little trick.
Oh, Perry, we would never do a thing like that.
Of course not. But the job of a cosmetic chemist is sometimes in optimizing your formula, you're going to have to think about these. And these are just a few different ways that you might go about making your formulas more marketing friendly, at least more friendly to the company's profit margins. Our next interview is with Dr. Johan Wiekers. He's a pharmacist by training, who earned his doctorate in 1989 in skin penetration enhancement at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. Following 6 years at Unilever in the UK, he joined Unikema in 1995 as the skin R&D director. He is a prolific author, publishing over 350 posters, book chapters, and columns. He served various roles in the IFSCC. Currently, Dr. Wiekers owns JW Solutions, a consultancy focused on various aspects of cosmetic science, such as skin delivery, skin sensory, topical formulation design, clinical trial design, skin bioengineering, and biostatistics. Welcome to the program, Dr. Wiekers.
Thank you, Perry. Pleasure to be with you today.
That's great. It's great to talk to you. You're right now in the Netherlands.
That's correct. I'm living in Gouda. Most people know that it's Gouda, the place where the cheese comes from. And actually, don't tell anybody else, but it's made by all my children in the backyard.
All right. We have you on the program today just to talk a little bit about, well, first of all, cosmetic science and how you got into it, and then to discuss the column that you, or a series of columns that you had written in Cosmetics and Toiletries about cosmetic science and whether it is, quote, bad science. So why don't we just get started with your background in cosmetic science? How did you get into it, and why are you still in there?
Now, the last question is easy to answer because I just love it. But how did I get in there? I did do indeed a PhD in skin penetration enhancement. I was doing this in an analytical department, so nobody could tell me anything about skin. So I was busy for about a year, and I discovered that actually skin was not the usual organ, and got myself more into studying skin, what it really was, keratinocytes, stratum corneum, and all these type of things. I actually enjoyed it that much that I ended up more in the dermatology department than in my own department. And when it was time to go somewhere else, because I had finished my PhD, I wrote a couple of letters and got some offers in the, from the pharmaceutical industry, but also from the cosmetic industry. And one of them was with Unilever Research, who at that moment in time asked for a skin delivery scientist. And I thought, I love skin delivery and I love being a scientist, so skin delivery scientist sounds the ideal thing. And that's how it started. I had done in my PhD only clinical work, so all in vivo work, studying skin penetration. And then I got in Unilever in England much more involved in the in vitro work. So I was basically starting to do what everybody else had been doing. Then I got, during my time in Unilever, involved in the development of a hair care brand with cosmetic claims substantiation and these type of things. And from that moment, I was kind of hooked. And when I made the transfer, at that moment in time, an internal transfer from Unilever Research to Unigema, which was at that moment in time still part of the Unilever group. Now, I never considered going back anywhere else. Although I do try to get a little bit of foot between the door in the pharmaceutical world.
So when you were going through college, did you really know about the cosmetic industry, or is that something you were thinking about during your undergraduate studies?
No, not at all. Not at all. When I studied pharmacy. I had the intention of becoming a registered pharmacist, but quite quickly on, I already decided that I was probably too much interested in the drug, but not in the patient. And that was not the right mentality to serve in a public pharmacy. Therefore, decided to do a PhD, then got hooked onto science, and the rest is as I described. I never considered, even during my PhD, I had only thought that I would end up in the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, that's great. It sounds like you're doing some fascinating work.
Yeah, I like it.
You're also writing some fascinating articles, and so I wanted to get into the articles that you wrote about the bad science. I thought it was just a fascinating discussion, and actually further discussed on LinkedIn, which was really great. So the basic premise of that article was to examine whether cosmetic science was really bad science. So after going through that, what was your conclusion? Is cosmetic science, is it really bad science?
It's interesting that you start with that question, because it is supposed to be a series of most likely five columns, and we've only had column three so far. So at the end of column five, I'm supposed to answer that question. So I'm not going to bite the bullet here and tell you what the end result of column five is, but it was quite evident that column number three was in a way the most controversial one up till now, because that was actually one where I discussed some issues where cosmetic science is not behaving as a proper science. Many other sciences are also doing doing the same. So it's not only cosmetic science. Let me just give an example. I went to the hospital because I had to do something over there, and this doctor is asking me what I'm doing, so I tell him, and he said, cosmetic science? Is cosmetic a science? Can you study cosmetic science? I mean, these people just throwing something in a bottle and they sell it for a ridiculous price. Now, this is just an example, and it's not because this gentleman was an arrogant medical doctor that knows everything better, etc., etc. This is the general perception that people have got of what we are doing. And you and I and all our listeners here will know that we do science, but there is also a lot of other stuff happening around. It's the same thing as saying you're a car salesman. That means you must be a liar. And that is doing great injustice to a lot of car sellers. But at the same time, there will be people that actually do things the wrong way. And that's the point that I'm trying to make.
So why do you think cosmetic science has developed this kind of reputation?
I think there are probably two reasons for it. And some of the discussions that we had on LinkedIn actually refer to that. First of all, because we are not alone, we cosmetic scientists, in bringing a product to the market. If we cosmetic scientists would do that, we would fail miserably, because we need to have marketeers, marketing colleagues that sell the stuff for us, that make it come to life with consumers that subsequently then buy our product. So on the one hand, we do science, good or bad, and that is then followed by the action of marketeers, who beautify the story to the most of their capabilities in order to get the product to be sold. And the second reason is the consumer. The consumer, you can roughly divide into three categories. One is, I just buy whatever is on the shelf. I don't read labels. I don't care about anything as long as it's cheap and it works. And there is another category that will believe almost anything you tell them. That is the consumer that believes that if you are 84 years old, you apply one drop of cream on a piece of skin, that he or she will look again like being 18 years old, whereas you and I all know that is simply physiologically impossible, but these people are so keen on having this stuff that they will believe almost anything. And finally, you got a category that whatever you do, it's not good because you're lying. Why? Because you're cosmetics and you're there for a dirty industry and you're only there to take my money. Now, so this is, of course, this is a very much helicopter view. And for this category that believes everything, these people will be disappointed from time to time. There's the first category I discussed, that basically just buy everything as long as it's cheap. These are the people that typically ask the question, yes, but is a bottle that's costing $400 per pot better than one that's only costing $20 per pot? And then the answer is, does a Ferrari drive any better than a Fiat or a Toyota? I mean, both get you from A to B. One may be more interesting to have than the other, but that's a very different thing. And the last category, I mean, that's, don't even start discussing with these people, because whatever you do it wrong anyway.
Right, right. So how do you see that the marketing influences the direction of the science?
Now, first of all, you have to say that cosmetic science is an applied science. That means it has to serve a purpose, which is to produce goods, produce products that deliver an effect to a consumer, which subsequently the marketeer can sell. Does marketing have an influence on that? Yes, absolutely. I remember one discussion a long time back where I was sitting in a taxi in Bangkok with a colleague of mine, and we were just stuck in a traffic jam. We discussed for hours something, and I said, I simply refuse to do the experiment. This is a stupid experiment you're asking me to do. It cannot be done. I mean, this is against any law of science that I know. And he said, you know what? You try to prove that I'm wrong. You give it your best shot so that you show me that I'm wrong. So I do the experiment, and it turns out that this guy, he was right. I thought this must be wrong. I must have done something wrong. So I do it again and again and a third time and a fourth time. And then finally had to admit that something which I had deemed to be completely impossible out of scientific principles was actually possible. Now, why do I then say this was possible? Because I tried to prove the opposite. I tried to show that this guy was wrong. And this type of stuff does happen. And this is an experiment, for instance, that any scientist in his right mind would never have done. So it is good that marketers do stretch us to go to the corners of the universe to try to do things which we think are impossible. Because sometimes you are amazed and you see things being possible that you didn't think were possible. So I have absolutely no difficulties by marketers stretching you as a scientist. They should be doing this. It's their job to basically get the best out of us.
So basically, marketers can have a positive influence on cosmetic science.
Yes, they absolutely can, and I believe they also have. Where things go wrong is when you see some evidence being taken, which is created by a cosmetic scientist, and kind of cherry picking the data. They only pick out the aspects that together build up a story, but ignore the things which were unfavorable. I saw some stuff the other day where we were talking about an active ingredient which had a ridiculous high molecular weight, and it even said in the papers it does not penetrate skin. But subsequently, it's supposed to work on fibroblasts and keratinocytes, which are deep down in the skin. I mean, a keratinocyte is not at the top, because that's a corneocyte. So it has to penetrate skin in order to get there. So then you think something doesn't sound good. But, okay, things can happen that you're not aware of. So let me look at the in vivo data. I look at the in vivo data, and what do I see there? Everything is going up or down as it should. So you think this looks very well. But what did they only show me? They only show me what the active is doing. There's no comparison with a placebo. Why? Because the placebo probably did do exactly the same. I mean, then I become skeptic and say, you know what? The placebo is doing exactly the same.
Right.
Now, and this is the stuff that then, for me, destroys the fun. So these people may have done excellent work, but if the placebo was indeed not active, they would have mentioned it.
Right.
So this immediately gets me skeptic, and not only me, because everybody wanting to buy this active ingredient will think exactly the same. And the interesting thing is that if you, I mean, I was working in the supplier industry, you go out there, you go to a firm, they first want to re-measure what you've measured because they do not believe you out of principle. Now, why? Because you are a supplier. And if that is the reason for not believing you, if a cosmetic manufacturing company doesn't believe us, suppliers, then why would a customer subsequently believe what the manufacturing industry is doing? Because they're doing exactly the same. They're playing exactly the same game. They portray their data in the most beautiful way. And of course, I cannot blame for it, but let's please be scientifically correct.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you talked about in your article was this idea of confirmation bias. How do you think cosmetic scientists can try to overcome a natural confirmation bias?
Yeah, this I also made in that column the remark that this is almost happening everywhere in all type of sciences. Why? Because if you are interested in showing that something is very active,
mm-hmm.
Let's say as a skin whitener, you're looking at the skin whitening effect, and you measure that, you study all that stuff, and something else may have happened in the body that that you may have measured, but simply don't see, because you're focusing on skin whitening. So you're looking at the delta L and the luminescence, how that's going, how the L value increases, and you look at the eta, the typological angle, those type of things. So you're only looking at what you want to see, because that's why you did do the study, and it's almost unavoidable to do this.
Mm-hmm.
This happens almost everywhere. How to avoid this is to have an open mind. That's number one. And number two, and this is getting more difficult in financial crisis times, but actually have the freedom to investigate a few things around your core purpose of only doing this. That's difficult. We even see it in the way how we study our literature. I mean, when I had to work out in the past the mechanism of action of one of my skin whiteners, I was looking in the traditional direction that everybody else was looking in. And this didn't work, that didn't work, that didn't work, that didn't work. I needed a consultant to come in to tell me, hey, why don't you look at this? And then it all developed, and it came about. Simply because, A, you can't know everything, and you tend to look at what everybody else is looking at. This is why you're looking in certain directions.
And really, just being aware that there is this confirmation bias can really help you be a better scientist anyway.
Absolutely.
We've talked about cosmetic science and the reputation it has. What do you think scientists can do to improve both the science and the reputation of cosmetic science?
There needs to be a clear distinction between the purpose why you are presenting something. Let's say you're sitting at a conference, and a bunch of people will present something. And you see this all the time. Everybody is presenting something because he or she wants to tell the audience about something. If you're telling the audience, buy this chemical, why? Because it's mine. Because in a nutshell, that is the most important reason. Buy it because it's mine. Then that's not going to help further cosmetic science. Although the work could have been done in such an excellent way, but then present it in a different way. Take the people by the hand through all the investigations that you've done, and don't beef it up, because what you will see is that if you present things in that way, the interest will come automatically. You'll get people coming to you and say, what chemical was that? Is it for sale? Can I have it? Et cetera, et cetera. So push the scientific angle, and in doing so, the sales will, yeah, kind of follow automatically. But if you are going out with the prime purpose to sell something, it will be a very different story, because people then will again not believe you.
Basically, your suggestion is to be sincere in your presentations, focus on the science, and the rest of the sales and marketing of raw materials is will just follow.
That often happens, yes. Depends on what you do, because I remember when in a presentation where I described statistical methods, how to analyze sensory data. Now, I don't think you're going to sell any ingredients from doing a thing like that. What that does do is some credibility building that you know what you're talking about. So therefore, when you come around next time and you show people some data, they would say, oh, yeah, now these people, this company knows what they're talking about.
It seems to be an inherent characteristic of applied science versus basic science anyway.
Correct. In fundamental science, you will not have that. There you will have different difficulties, which I do not see happening in cosmetic science. That's where big egos come in, where ego one is more important than ego two, and normally they're from two opposing labs that never quote each other or things like that.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to know that everybody has their issues. One final question. And this is related to cosmetic science in general. What do you think are the most interesting areas of research going on in cosmetic science? If someone new to the field was coming in and they looked at all the work that's being done, what areas do you think are the most interesting at the moment?
I actually think the physical sciences within cosmetic science. So what do I mean? If you look at, and it's a column I wrote a long while ago for Cosmetic and Toiletries magazine. If you look at the way how the Koreans and the Japanese are dealing with anti-aging, you see that the Japanese take a very much a biological approach where chemicals interfere with something in the skin, so they have to penetrate, etc., and do whatever they need to do. And this, by definition, takes a long while. Whereas the Koreans work on particles with all kind of fancy surface properties that give you an immediate effect, and because it's done on the surface, they never get into the difficulty, is this going to be a drug, a quasi-drug, or anything of that sort. And I think that there's a lot more that we as a cosmetic industry could obtain from that field. So from particles, from solid particle technology in cosmetic science. So a second thing that I see is actually current tendency, the trend in the industry to move to simpler formulations. It used to be, and there are still many products on the market that contain 50 or 60 ingredients. And that only was because if you were asked to create the next blockbuster product for your company, you always added something. You never took something out because you could take away that what made the product so great in the past. But having more ingredients, people are now gradually realizing if you've got 60 ingredients in a product, it means you have to have 60 products on stock. You need to have PIPs, product information packages, containing now 60 ingredients rather than 12, and all kind of things like that. The number of interactions is increasing, the concentrations of everything is going down, and what do we get at the end of the day? We get something that is so complex that we can't work with it any longer. We are working out gradually what all the individual ingredients are doing and how they influence each other, and in doing that, it is possible to go back from formulating from first principles. And if I was a young cosmetic scientist, that's what I would be working on. And could I produce a computer program where I could say, this is the active that I want. These are the emollients and emulsifiers that I would like to use, the preservatives. So you kind of type in a couple of these things, and a formulation pops out. And I think this will even happen during my lifetime.
Well, that would be really interesting to see that happen. Well, Dr. Vickers, thank you so much. That brings us to the end of our interview. If you have anything, any last words you want to add?
Please, folks, all be true to cosmetic science and don't think that it's only the marketeers that are messing it up for us or the consumers that are messing it up for us. We all need to do this together. We are in it together and we are only capable of working together.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Vickers. You can contact Dr. Vickers his website, jwsolutions.com. Okay, you ready for the fun challenge?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay.
First, let's reveal the answer from last week. I have to say, we were inundated with responses last week.
Wow.
Yeah. So just to remind you of last week's challenge, say Usain Bolt, you and me were running a 100-meter dash. I suppose further that we each ran a uniform speed the whole race. If Usain beat you by 10 meters and you beat me by 10 meters, how much did Usain beat me by? And nobody really got the proper answer, although many people guessed the incorrect answer, which was it's not 20 meters. And in fact, the answer is 19 meters. And the way you get that is if you think about it, when Usain crosses the finish line, you are at the 90-meter mark. And if I'm running 9 meters for every 10 that you run, if you're at the 90-meter mark, I would be at the 81-meter mark. And so that's where I would be when Usain finished. So there you go, a little tricky 19 meters. Are you ready for the new challenge?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. I've mixed this up a little bit. Today's challenge is a little different. So you all can play along at home. I'm going to challenge Kelly here to see if she can sniff out the thing that I made up and from the things that are actually real beauty gadgets. So we have three beauty gadgets. I'm going to describe three beauty gadgets here. Two of them are actually real, and one of them I just completely made up. You just have to tell me which one sounds the most made up. Okay, number one, a wand that shoots oxygen into your skin to smooth and tone. Item number two, a ceramic unipolar magnet that gets rid of acne. And item number three, an electronic headband that relaxes muscles and removes wrinkles. So, is the fake one the oxygen shooting wand, the ceramic acne getting rid of magnet, or the electronic headband?
Oh my goodness. You know, I think electronic headband, I've seen electrophoretic devices for delivery of actives. That sounds like it could be reasonable. The unipolar magnets, I'm kind of questioning. You know what? I'm going to say that the fake one is the unipolar magnet.
That one seemed the least reasonable to you.
Yeah, I'm not sure how a magnet would affect acne, since a lot of acne treatments target the P. acnes on the skin, or, you know, removal of oils or so forth. So that one, to me, I'm not sure how a magnet would take care of acne.
All right. Well, I will tell you that the electronic headband was actually a real device that I found on the internet. I'll put a link to it so people can go ahead and see it. But it's this funny picture of this lady with this headband around her head, and it's like this pulsating thing in the middle of her brain. It's fabulous. And number one, the wand that shoots oxygen into the skin. You really believe that that was real?
Well, whether or not it would really work, would somebody market it, perhaps?
Well, you are correct, because someone is marketing the wand that shoots oxygen into their skin, which means that the one I made up was the unipolar magnet that gets rid of acne. And, you know, magnets are claimed to do everything, so I didn't think it was much of a stretch.
Do I win a prize?
No, but I'm keeping track of your score, so you've got 100% right now. So that's the show. Just a few quick announcements. Of course, as always, go visit chemistcorner.com and leave questions and comments about cosmetic science, the blog, and the show. We love to see feedback from people. Thank you for all the feedback we got on the last show. We got that through LinkedIn, through Twitter, through the blog, and in person. So thanks everybody for that. Just a reminder, I'm going to be speaking at the Twin Cities SEC meeting on February 16th. Also, I'll be teaching a class on how cosmetic chemists can productively use the internet. This will be in New Jersey on April 27th, 2010. That will be a fun class. I'm sure you're sad you're going to miss it there, right, Kelly?
I am. I wish I could be there.
You have anything coming up, Kelly?
Yes, I do, Perry. The Ohio Valley chapter of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists will be having their scientific meeting on February 17th at the Montgomery Inn here in Cincinnati, Ohio. We will be having Nancy Mills of Klein & Company, who is the industry manager for their consumer products division, talked to us about the increasingly complex and sophisticated consumer in the cosmetic and personal care market. Should be very interesting. So if you live in the Cincinnati area or, you know, close enough to drive, I would definitely make the trip.
And you'll get to see the coolest cosmetic chemist in the whole world.
I will be there.
You are still the coolest cosmetic chemist, right? Could we check that up on Google?
You know, I have not checked in a little while. I'll have to check tonight now that you mentioned it.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Do you have anything to add, Kelly?
Yes. Thank you for helping us make the world a more beautiful place through cosmetic chemistry.
All right, now go make a difference.